Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Do you, have we talked about this? Do you know what the last American movie released on VHS was?
No.
I'm going to guess it's A History of Violence.
Good guess. Yes.
I might have known it was something you had something to do with.
I have one framed on my wall. You mean because I kill mediums?
Congratulations on killing VHS.
Yes. Well, they brought it back now, so I don't.
Yeah, along with vinyl.
Yeah.
Yep.
But vinyl's not ironic. Well, you know, VHS is, no one's bringing back VHS because it looks or sounds better.
No, and also, you know, the oxidation comes off. So right. It's not exactly an archival medium.
Yeah. But I do get nostalgic for those, the tracking disorders and.
I only get nostalgic for the boxes in the video stores that allowed people to go in and browse as if they were in a library.
Yes.
Now they have to just look at Netflix and say, what's that mean?
Well, I have, it wouldn't be an episode if I didn't mention that I've got the British Blu-ray of Mandy, which came in a mock VHS box.
He's never happy unless he's plugging Mandy every single episode.
How do we sound, Don? We good? I guess we could segue into
actually starting.
To actually doing a show. It's weird. We don't normally wear headphones. Is it sounding weird?
Yeah, should I go
it
get
It sounds
headphones?
Weird, but if he says it's okay, it must be fine.
Sounds okay to you? It sounds weird to me.
It's all bassy
for
us.
You want me to get headphones as a sign of solidarity?
No.
No. It would be better if I could take mine off and you wouldn't talk. Then I wouldn't. That's the only problem is I can't hear you with that.
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
This week, our guest is Robert Kraskowski, the writer-director of absolutely fantastic and unique new film, The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot, which I should also say is my favorite Sam Elliott movie of the past few years. It's an astonishing film because it's not the movie you'd expect from that title.
And it's his own double feature.
And it's its own double feature. No, it's a beautiful kind of elegiac meditation on violence, on mythology, on America, on war, on Bigfoot. Just a wonderful film. And thank you for joining us, Robert. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you both for having me. Good to be here with you guys.
You have come here today to discuss with us a subject that actually ties into your own film. You must agree. I like to do that, Joe. I like to. Do you want to tell Joe what your topic is?
Yeah, I
like
thought
an
it'd
old
be
quiz
fun
show.
To, I thought it'd be fun to talk about American myth making and the movies that are made about America and Americans that are done in kind of a mythic way, or their function is to kind of add to the conversation of myth making in America. And I thought that might be a fun topic. So there's going to be some that are maybe big and a little obvious, and hopefully a few that are interesting at least to talk about. And that's a huge subject. We could go pretty deep, but you guys can
for many hours.
Anything that comes to mind, go for it.
Yeah, don't worry. By the time this is over, we will have gotten so far from the topic.
That's our specialty.
Good. All right, I like that.
But do you want to just start walking us through what's your first?
Do you want me to start at the bottom of the list?
I like to say start with your least favorite favorite.
My least favorite favorite. There's no least favorite.
Everyone says that. God.
It's because it wouldn't be on the list if it wasn't a favorite.
Start at the bottom. Work your way up.
Okay, I'm going to start with a odd movie. It's not quite a movie. It's a trilogy. It's called The Beaver Trilogy. It was made in 1979, 1981, and 1985 by Trent Harris. Have either of you guys seen that?
Yes. Are they actually legitimately available? I felt like they were, like I got them through the weird VHS bootleg community many years ago.
That was pretty much it. I went to a kind of a cult video store that we had locally. It lasted about 3 years and they had a section of really oddball stuff. And I saw that and it stuck with me forever as a really interesting way to keep repeating the same story and building off of it. And clearly, Richard Levon Griffiths, who calls himself Groovin' Gary in the movie, he's a real guy. And Trent Harris was, I think, just testing out a camera in a parking lot. And this guy in Beaver, Utah kind of came up to him and was started doing impressions of Stallone and John Wayne. And they got talking about this talent show that this guy was going to do in about a month. And so Trent Harris came back with his camera crew and documented it. And the guy wanted to play on stage. He was going to do Olivia Newton-John singing "Please Don't Keep Me Waiting."
Right.
And at the end of that, you can't quite tell how the town reacts to it. I mean, he does it in full drag, and there's just kind of this sense of unease as you're watching it, that it was something that this guy, Groovin' Gary, really needed to get out and needed to do. And Trent Harris was so fascinated with it, he remade it twice, once with Sean Penn and then again with Crispin Glover.
Right.
Yeah.
And by the way, I was just looking to see, I haven't gotten very far in my search, if it's available commercial. Do you know these films?
No. These
videos. But Beaver Trilogy Part 4 is available on iTunes and Prime Video.
Oh, wow.
I don't even know what that is.
This time.
I have no idea. But yeah, that's right. So he recreates them, right, with these actors.
Yeah. Yeah, he recreates them and builds on them. So it's kind of taking this small town guy and making him this local legend, and this idea of him, he's clearly trying to pursue fame, and I understand that he was never very happy that this trilogy kind of came to be, and that it kind of brought a lot of attention his way that maybe he wasn't looking for, even though clearly he was interested in being famous when it started out. And he's obviously this really sweet guy that cares about his community and is just excited to be in front of a camera. And I think it's an interesting exploration of what happens when you actually kind of get some level of that notoriety that you might be looking for. So I thought that was a pretty oddball one, but it was one that was nagging at me to leave it off this list. I kind of had to do it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, of him repeating this theme over and over.
And now I have to find out if they're commercially available. I may still even have my crappy old VHS somewhere, but it would be fun to see those again.
Check YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure they're on YouTube, right?
Yeah, I know there's got to be some Groovin' Gary clips on YouTube. So they're fun to watch and. That stuck with me a long time. So there's that one.
Fantastic.
Let's go to 1939 for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Oh, we're all over the place. This is great. Yeah, that is, it's funny. I was just talking to somebody about that the other day. Someone recently pointed out it's probably the only time that a filibuster has actually been used for something good. Yeah, great film.
I mean, just this notion, especially right now, of somebody standing alone, and all they've got is their integrity, and they stand up against this incredible amount of power and corruption and all these influences, and he stays true to who he is and what he believes in. It's I believe it's a matter involving some land that he wanted for the Boy Scouts. And he finds out that there's a bunch of corruption around it because some senators want it for some big business. And he stands his ground and almost loses everything in the process. And the movie is not all fun and games. There's something really, it's a Frank Capra movie, and it has kind of a screwball comedy element to part of it. And then it gets real dark and heavy as this guy's world kind of collapses around him. All of his idealism is tested. And I think that that's an interesting movie in today's conversation. And it was certainly interesting at the time. It was actually very controversial at the time. People had a big problem with it.
Well, in the late 60s, it was revived. And, you know, the counterculture was sort of programmed to think that Frank Capra movies were kind of just corny and flag waving and all that. And then when they get to the scene where the marching Boy Scouts are fire hosed by the bad guys, everybody was shocked. I mean, they couldn't believe that in 1939, that kind of an image would be allowed to be, you know, popular. It turned a lot of minds around, that picture. You know, it starts out as one kind of movie and then ends up as, you know, something somewhat slightly subversive.
Yeah, subversive is a good term for it. Because watching it today, it feels every bit as relevant as it did then. In some ways, maybe even more so.
For sure. I mean, I don't, you know, we never get political on this show.
Hardly ever.
I thought about it. I think the reason I was talking about it with a friend recently was watching Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota. Did you see her grilling Elliot Abrams last week? Which I have never in my life seen a sitting U.S. congressperson do something that audacious.
Well,
and
they
courageous.
Just don't go there.
They don't
but
go
that's,
there.
That's the whole thing with this new wave of people. They don't know what the rules are yet.
Yeah. And I thought that is the first time in my life I have seen someone do something that really made me think of Jimmy Stewart in that movie. Mm-hmm. Quavering voice, stumbling over her written statement, this tiny, diminutive woman standing up to this absolute monster in front of all these people and just violating all the norms that say you're not.
Point of order.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Yeah, I love that movie. Jimmy Stewart, so when he's up there and he's quavering and he's just, he's, I don't know, words are failing me right now. I apologize. But yeah, his filibuster is incredible in that film.
Yeah, he looks like he's in agony emotionally and physically, and he plays so perfectly. I think one of the, an example of emotion that's that real, there's a small moment in Captain Phillips when Tom Hanks has kind of a nervous breakdown at the end of the movie. And it reminded me just of the level to which Jimmy Stewart was going in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I think Tom Hanks, there's something there when you can kind of make your whole body and your whole energy go to that place. I mean, it sticks with you forever because you believe it. I think there was some part of Jimmy Stewart that he was speaking some truth through that movie. So
sure. Would that, Joe, I'm glad. Was that after his time at war? Yeah. Right.
After his what?
After his time at war?
No. It was before.
That was before.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause I know in, It's a Wonderful Life, he was sort of,
well, when he, you know, it's interesting because, you know, see, well, when he came back from the war, he was toughened up and he was darker and all that stuff. But no, he had, that stuff was all there. He didn't have that many roles that were allowed him to tap into that.
But it reminds me of those sort of emotional scenes at the end of It's a Wonderful Life where he clearly was sort of tapping into some of his.
Well, yeah. I mean, the despair factor alone in that picture. But then, you know, I mean, Vertigo and Winchester 73. I mean, these are dark characters.
Yeah.
Man from Laramie.
Well, it's what somebody said once, and it's true. I mean, people always compare Tom Hanks to him. I mean, you just did. And I keep waiting for Tom Hanks to have.
By coincidence.
but I keep waiting for him to have that stage in his career where he starts going into those darker places. Clearly he can do it. I think it would be.
Well, he's playing Mr. Rogers next, so you're going to get your wish.
He's already played Walt Disney, so he's. He doesn't seem to be going into too dark.
He's got to. He's so good.
And it's worth saying that Sam Elliott, his acting heroes are Gary Cooper and Jimmy Stewart. So he told me that when I first met him. And I won't spoil. There's a movie coming up on the list. So I guess we'll get into it later.
Or you could just skip to it.
I could. Okay. Well, you want me to skip to it?
Sure. Why not?
Let's talk about High Noon from 1952.
I knew you were going to say High Noon.
Yes.
Which there's a very good book out about the making of High Noon, which it ties it in also with the political situation at the time. And it's I happened to Catch High Noon Again, which is one of my favorite movies on TV, and it's one of those pictures that I just stop and watch it because it's so well made. And so it's that took me back to the book, and it was really interesting about the background of that picture and the fights that went on between Stanley Kramer and Carl Foreman, and the fact that Gary Cooper was everybody thought he was miscast, and he was also very kind of ill during the movie.
Wait, sorry, they thought he was miscast.
Yeah. Yeah. They thought he was too old.
Oh, okay. All right.
And how too old for Grace Kelly.
Yeah, well, okay. You
know? Yeah, I mean, I just think that it takes place in real time, and it's a moral dilemma. Very, very simple. Do I stay or do I go? And what happens to everybody if I do this? What happens to my family? He just got married in the opening of the movie, and the movie's incredibly realistic. There's nothing cartoonish about the situation. As it goes on, you realize how alone he is and that everyone's reasons for abandoning him are kind of valid.
There's
a bit of cowardice there with a couple of the characters, and then there's some that just know this is completely futile and we can't help you. And I love that it's, I think, 85 minutes, and it just is this slow burn with no shootouts and no action until the last 10 minutes, and then it explodes. And I kind of feel like a movie like Die Hard tips its hat to a movie like High Noon, except the action starts 20 minutes into Die Hard and never stops. But High Noon's just a very cerebral, mythic movie. I was trying to think of what's kind of the most mythic Western. And I think this one says something about the type of people we aspire to be, and this kind of American ideal that we look up to for better or worse. I think it's kind of all there in High Noon.
And, you know, interestingly, the real-time aspect was kind of imposed on it after a bad preview. There was a subplot with two other characters, a different marshal who was bringing in a bad guy, and it used to intercut between the two stories, and that just wasn't working at the preview. And when they brought in Elmo Williams to sort of rejigger it, the idea came up: let's shoot lots of clocks, let's make the whole thing happen in the time it takes to tell it. And of course, it's a masterpiece of editing, that picture.
Who's the other marshal?
It was an actor named James Brown who ended up as Lieutenant Rip Masters on the Rin Tin Tin television show. So it was obviously it was a break he didn't get.
Joe gets annoyed when I say he's seen every movie and knows everything about them.
That's true. I haven't. I know some stuff.
And
what I've
movie haven't
more.
You seen?
Until a couple of days ago, I hadn't seen his.
So we've seen everything. I just showed High Noon to my wife, a couple months ago, and yeah, she flipped for it. I mean, how do you not? But Grace Kelly is such an amazing, it's funny, as a kid, obviously I key into Gary Cooper because
she's just the girl.
She's just the girl. But when you're a 12-year-old boy, it's like, and as an adult, I'm watching and it's like, she is such the heart and soul of that movie.
And she does so much acting. I mean, she's all with her eyes.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, and in the end, when she actually helps him, picks up a gun and kills somebody, that would not work in 9 out of 10 movies. It would feel like a ploy or cheap or just convenient. There's something about the way they build that up and the look on her face, like Joe said, that's just all in her eyes. Her having to do that says a lot.
And having been a Quaker and having lost some of her family to guns, and the characters, it's one of the best written movies that I can think of.
Yeah. Just saying to a friend the other day, I think of all the people on this list, the writer I'd want to talk to the most would be that one, because they're tapping into something so specific. It's really, it's a big, broad Western idea, and yet it's brought down to this incredible focus point. And I can't even think of a novella, but it was based on Tin Star.
Yeah, short story.
John Cunningham. It has a literary background, but sure is good.
Have you ever read it, Joe?
The short story?
Yeah.
I did read it around the time that I read the original script, which I had a copy of, which is how I knew about the subplot. And it's not actually that much like the movie.
That seems to be the case with especially that era.
Yeah.
They usually take one or two elements and just go in an entirely different direction. But what else do you have for us, Robert?
All right, let's see. Let's go to 2007, and we'll do There Will Be Blood. It's inspired by an Upton Sinclair novel, Oil. And I've read Oil, and it only strings just the tiniest elements from it. I almost wonder if he put that on there sarcastically, but I'm sure it was inspired by it. But I think that the power and the greed and this kind of lonely, singular character, he speaks to a certain type of American ideal that is to be avoided at all costs. And Paul Thomas Anderson somehow makes this entire movie, and I don't think he preaches once. There's a lot of preaching in the movie, literally,
yes.
But it doesn't feel like a preachy movie. And I think that Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, basically doing a spot-on impersonation of John Huston for 2.5 hours, is fascinating. And it's this big, larger-than-life, almost Captain Ahab character who's just singularly possessed about oil. And I think that might be, again, a comment on the times that the movie had come out in, and then also it's timeless because it doesn't seek to make a statement on any of that. So I don't know. What do you guys think of that call?
Yeah, and I think he is a sort of quintessential American villain because he's so magnetic, and you know, people love quoting him in spite of the fact that, you know,
because they like milkshakes.
Yeah,
yeah.
I drink your milkshake. I mean, how do you not? And I think that's something that's sort of compelling about a lot of American villains is that they are these sort of wild characters, larger than life. I mean, I find myself, I grew up in Philadelphia under Mayor Frank Rizzo, one of the most egregious racist monsters who ever lived. And I still find myself every now and then yearning for the days when we had politicians like that. <You know? laughs> It was just because he was
so,
at least
so much simpler then.
Big and audacious and, you know, but I enjoy that film. I'm always thrown by the, and I, is it a stupid thing to get hung up on the Paul Dano casting of the, or there's no mention made of the fact that he's playing two different people?
Well, my understanding is that they had cast a different actor and had gone quite ways down the road with that.
Yeah.
And they just decided, okay, let's just have Paul Dano do it again. And the first time I saw it, it was super confusing. I didn't, if Daniel was hallucinating or he'd lost his mind or it was just a strange gimmick or trick, but I'm so used to it now. I love it. I think it's a great call. I also think it's interesting that Paul Dano plays Eli Sunday and his brother Paul, and then Daniel Day-Lewis is playing Daniel Plainview. So both of these guys are using their real names on some level.
It had to be confusing. But yeah, so it did. It works out for you because it really did throw me the first time. It seemed to be such a strange thing to do.
There was kind of a trilogy that came out that year in 2007 that all kind of spiritually match each other with There Will Be Blood, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, and No Country for
Old Men. Yes.
That was about as good a year for American myth-making as you can get. And I'd love to talk about all three, but we just don't have time. But I wonder how jarring was the death of Llewellyn in No Country for Old Men for you guys, the off-screen death. Did you guys have a hard time with that, or did you like it?
Oh, well, joke, though.
Well, what am I? I drop an opinion on
this? No, I'm just afraid.
I think a lot of people had trouble with it because it's so against the norm of what movies do, which is to show you things happening. And considering the fact that there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty as to what actually had taken place, and then it's bookended by the last speech from Tommy Lee Jones, which mm-hmm. is really good. I think a lot of people were just found it confusing. I think they just didn't understand. Well, why can't I see that? Whereas in real life, of course, very often you never see it.
You don't see it.
You know,
I loved it,
and I think that's why they did it.
I absolutely loved it. It was, I love that moment of realization that they had just bumped off what you thought was the main character off screen.
Yeah.
There's that joy of, you know, watching someone do something new that works, that makes sense, that joy of feeling like, wow, I'm like, this must have been to some extent what it felt like to see Janet Leigh get killed in the shower if you would see Psycho opening day. It was like, you didn't see that coming either. And then something about, it's funny, you mentioned John Sayles earlier, maybe that's why I'm thinking of it, but in some ways it reminded me of the end of Limbo, which is, I think, probably my favorite ending of a movie in which the entire audience around me is going, what the fuck? And I'm going, oh.
That worked. That, I love that kind of thing in film. I have no problem with it being abrupt or being suggested. Yeah. And I think that it's just how confident are the filmmakers in that move. And I think that the Coen brothers at that point in their career, I mean, they started out basically pretty perfect, but at that point they were just full-blown masters. And for them to make that move is a statement, that, and I think a really, really cool one that a lot of people hadn't seen before. So it completely tripped me up when they first did it. I was for 10 minutes, I'm like, where is this character? Where did he go? I didn't get it. And then realizing, like Joe said, or you, one of you guys said about Tommy Lee Jones' speech at the end, and you kind of realize that not showing it leaves this vacuum in the movie that's really interesting. And then it's one of the very few movies I can think of where it's actually really rewarding that the bad guy wins somehow. There's something about that movie where him winning is the right move for that movie, even though he breaks his arm.
But yeah, he does get all kind of messed up. So I love that film to death. That's probably my second favorite Coen Brothers. We were just talking about this the other day. I'm a Miller's Crossing junkie of the highest order. But speaking of American Myth, it's amazing how much richer that movie gets every time I see it.
Yeah, same.
Well, that's the secret. Of a good movie. That's why we go back. You know, if it's the same movie every time.
Yeah.
Then it kind of loses its luster.
Yes.
But it's like when I saw 8.5, I was, 13 years old, and I thought one thing about it, and then I saw it when I was in my 20s, and I thought something else. Then I got into the movie business, and then I looked at it completely differently. And then I got older, and again, it's a different movie. I mean, those are the movies that really reward you when you keep coming back to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, same.
There was also, have I told you the story before about the big argument with Cronenberg and the villain scene? That we had a scene in History of Violence where the two bad guys come across a woman whose car is broken down. You think, I'll just be very short, you think they're going to kill her, and the scene ends with the realization that they didn't, and is one of the few things that David and I really fought tooth and nail about. And he was like, why would I show this? What's the point? And I was like, it's to get across the mystery and the horror of these guys without them actually doing anything. And he was like, that's ridiculous. And then a year later, I'm watching No Country for Old Men. And one of the most terrifying scenes in that movie is the one where he doesn't kill the guy. I mean, it's just an amazing sequence with a coin and it's your lucky day, friendo. I felt very vindicated by that.
It's a great scene. And that's a great haircut also.
Yes, great haircut.
All right, let's go to 1989 for Do the Right Thing.
Can we stay there?
Yeah, I mean, written and directed by Spike Lee. Ernest Dickerson is the DP on that, who had shot Brother from Another Planet. And I think that I couldn't find it in any interviews or any research I was doing, but I think that he was trying to make something mythic in making this movie. I mean, having the mayor and mother sister feel almost like a king and a queen that kind of preside over all of the goings on of this day, and then having the element of it being the hottest day of the year, sure. So putting more pressure on the situation. People speak in soliloquies. I feel like Samuel L. Jackson's character is almost like the Greek chorus. Certainly the guys that are against the big red wall.
Yep.
Kind of commenting on everything that's happening around them in almost a kind of sarcastic and aloof way.
Radio Raheem just wandering in and out of scenes with his one song. And
constantly playing Public Enemy. Fight the Power over and over again. I don't know. I love that movie. And it felt right for this conversation. So I don't know. Again, what do you guys think?
No, that's a mythic movie.
Yeah, absolutely, and a masterpiece, and I can't say enough about that one. It was jaw dropping. I remember seeing. It's one of those movies where I remember everything about where I saw it and who I saw it with and what our reaction.
I bet you don't remember that about Driving Miss Daisy.
Was that? Yeah, that's right.
That was
the same year.
That was the year
that got his Oscar. I'm blanking that out traumatically. There's a lovely little movie. Shit. Blanket on the title.
He'll add out the part where he says,
South Side with You. God damn it. There's a movie that came out a couple years ago about Barack Obama and Michelle Obama's first date.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And it's a sweet film, but there's an amazing scene at the end. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm. I told you.
And not I.
Wow. Can't see everything.
She doesn't want the people they work with to see them dating because she's just gotten this job and she thinks it'll diminish her standing with them. It's that era. She's a woman, et cetera. They walk out of the movie and their first date was Do the Right Thing. And they run into the white boss at the law firm she works at. And they're talking about the end of the movie. And her boss sees them and comes over. And he says, "So I liked it. I go, I didn't really like the ending, though. What do you think the ending was about?" And Barack goes, "Well, he saw that these people were in danger, and he knew that the only way to save them was to throw the trash can through the window to deflect the attention away from them. So he saved his friend's life by doing this other thing because he understood the crowd." And the guy goes, "Oh, that makes sense. Oh, great." And he walks away, and Michelle turns to him. She goes, "Is that what you think happened?" And he goes, "No, he was fucking angry." And it was just such a beautiful use of that film to sort of highlight something interesting about Obama and the culture and everything else. But that ending is one that, you know, you can't help but talk about even 20, 30 years later.
Yeah, and I like that the discussion around it is always that the ending is kind of ambiguous.
Yeah.
And it's a mirror for the audience. What you see in that ending is says something about you. And and then the conflicting quotes at the end, one of them saying that violence can sometimes be necessary and that you never resort to violence.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just as good as it gets. So I love
it. It really is. I also love that apparently Spike went to Chuck D and said, "I need you to write the greatest rap anthem ever." And Chuck D came back a few days later with Fight the Power.
Oh, wow.
And that's he did it. Sure, no problem.
That's pretty great.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right. Let's go to 1941 and talk about Sullivan's Travels.
Sullivan's Travels.
One of the great movies about making movies.
Yes.
I had to have one about making movies because that's a mythic aspect of the American culture. And then also it's about, this period of, in time where people were so incredibly depressed and impoverished. And it's a great screwball comedy and a great social commentary. And it does it all without, without preaching too much. It just works for the movie. I don't know, Joe, you could probably run down the synopsis better than I could.
Well, you know, it's Joel McRae as a movie director who's been very successful making comedies with titles like Ants in Your Plants of 1939. And he feels that he needs to say something about the world we live in, which is, you know, there's a lot of homelessness. There's a lot of, it's made in 1940, but I think it's almost looks like it was set about 3 years earlier because the depression is at its height and there's a hobo jungle. And anyway, he decides that in order to, he can't make his magnum opus without suffering. And so he has to go and disguise himself as one of the people and go out and feel miserable and learn about their misery in order to be able to make this film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is the movie he wants to make about social problems. And all of his friends try to talk him out of it. And
they follow him around.
And they follow him around in an Airstream trailer so that he'll be able to have, you know, be able to eat and take a shower and all that kind of stuff. And he really doesn't want to do that. So he meets this girl played by Veronica Lake, and she's kind of down on her luck. And anyway, he ends up going out on his own, and he gets in trouble. And he ends up in a chain gang. And when he's at his lowest moment of despair, he goes to a black church where they're running cartoons for the prisoners. The prisoners come in, and the parishioners move back a couple of rows, and the prisoners come in. They run a Mickey Mouse cartoon, a Pluto cartoon, it's just music. No, there's no effects, and everybody starts laughing, and Joel McRae, who is pretty down, also starts to laugh, and he starts to realize how funny it is and how wonderful it is to be surrounded by people who, no matter how miserable they are, have found this moment of levity watching this silly cartoon. And it changes his whole view about making those kind of movies. And maybe it's okay to make comedies because they do uplift people. And it's a much better movie than that synopsis. But it's filled with great characters and the Preston Sturges stock company of people. And it's a remarkable movie.
It's just so well written. There's this great little device. The studio hides a card in his shoes in case anything happens to him. They'll have this card that identifies him. And this homeless guy steals his shoes and gets hit by a train, and they think he's dead and was murdered. And it's such a clever device. At the end, he admits to murdering himself so that he can get on the front page of the newspaper, so somebody can come find him because he's so lost in the jungle of homelessness. And then he won't make the movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, when all said and done. He said it was too real and too raw, and I can't make that movie now, which disappoints all of the guys that initially didn't want him to go on this adventure because now they're fully bought into it. It's so good, and it's a big mythic American movie, and it talks a lot about how we treat one another and our privilege, and this wealthy guy assuming he can go learn something in relative comfort, and then having all that stripped from him is interesting. It's a good movie.
It was great. Yeah, I was struggling a bit with everything else. As soon as you said it, I sort of grasped the mythic nature of Sullivan's Travels. Doesn't leap to mind as a mythic film for me, but
well, the movies he's making are myths. He's giving the myths to the public,
right.
And he's now living the things that he's been only creating in a false way. And that's why at the end of the picture, he says the reason he can't make the movie is because he hasn't suffered enough.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, if you wanted a more mythic one, in place of this one was going to talk about It's a Wonderful Life, but we know that movie, everybody. Yeah. And I love it, and it's great. But I felt like Sullivan's Travels says as much, just in a different direction.
Yeah.
And it's not as well known as it should be.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I'm going to move to 1987, a movie called Matewan, written and directed by John Sayles. This movie and Raiders of the Lost Ark were the two movies that made me want to make movies. Raiders, because it just looked like so much fun to get to make a movie. And then Matewan, I saw it at a young age and realized that this is what you can do with movies. You can say something without preaching, and it can still be incredibly entertaining. And I've never really stopped thinking about this movie, and I wish more filmmakers from my generation would look at and study this movie, because I think it's as important and as meaningful as a movie like The Godfather. So
yes, it's hard to find. There is I think you can get it on iTunes or something, but I mean, I'm sure you know.
Even when it was new, it didn't get great distribution, as often many of John's films didn't.
Well, I asked him when I got to that great Q&A with him a couple of years ago about specifically, like, when the hell do we get a Blu-ray of this thing? And I guess the rights are all so scattered.
Well, when you make independent pictures with multiple sources of finance, it sometimes gets very complicated.
It's a glorious film. It's funny. How many movies have you brought up that are not preachy and yet have preachers in them.
John Sayles plays the hard shell.
Yes.
That's be your evangelical side.
By the way, I got to ask him, I don't know if you've had, I asked him once, why does he always cast himself as assholes? And and he said it's because, he saves money putting himself in the films, and it's hard enough directing the thing without having to think about where your character is on his journey. But assholes are always assholes.
So where did you meet John?
John and I were developing just briefly a project. I mean, he and the composer Joe Kramer and myself, we were all born about 15 minutes from each other. I was born in Albany, John in Schenectady, and Joe was raised in the Albany area. So we all kind of came from the same neck of the woods, and John was working on a movie about the Rosenberg trial that I had read and had an opportunity to potentially produce, and it didn't end up working out. But John and I stayed in touch for years, and he read The Man Who Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot and my comic Elsie Hooper, and I think was just really encouraging, and we talked a lot about movies, and he wound up coming on board the short film of Elsie Hooper, and then ultimately Hitler and Bigfoot as executive producer on those, shepherding the project and helping me make sure that I didn't hit some of the rocks along the way that you can hit when you're trying to make an ambitious independent film. And the movie wouldn't exist if it weren't for him. So it's really strange that it came back around that I'll get to work with him, because I tell you the truth, you can ask anybody who knows me, Mate One was a movie I was completely obsessed with growing up. So
I believe you. I mean, it's a phenomenal film. I probably watch it every couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's about.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Sure.
It's a coal miners' revolution in the 1920s, and it's in West Virginia. It's a town called Matewan, and there's a labor union dispute, and it erupts into violence in the town. And why I think this movie is mythic is because what John Wisely does is he taps into what we love about Westerns. I mean, the end of the movie is a full-blown Western shootout, and you've been waiting. This powder keg is building and building, and the tension. And it's just an incredible cast of characters. Chris Cooper as Joe Kenahan, and James Earl Jones as Few Clothes Johnson, and David Strathairn, the dual gun wielding Sid Hatfield. Do you guys know, is he supposed to be related to the Hatfields and the McCoys?
Yeah, or
is
that That's right.
Who's first film?
Chris Cooper's. Because I had never seen him before. And you're right. And the great thing about the Strathairn character is he is there because Chris Cooper is very much not a Western hero. But every now and then when you need that little bit of grit, David Strathairn shows up and says, I wouldn't piss on him if his heart was on fire. he's such a badass in that movie.
He's the first realistic character in a movie that wields two guns.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that movie. I love that it kind of has a secret narrator. You're wondering who's the narrator of this movie the whole time. And it goes right back to the kid who is in Mary McDonald's house the whole time. It's Will Oldham playing Danny. And he was kind of observing all of these events. And he was a young preacher in the town and had a very different opinion of the John Sayles preacher and of what was happening in his town. And it speaks to their grit and their tenacity and the right to work. The notion that these people just wanted a fair wage, and the people who owned the mines were renting them their equipment, and were renting them their houses and owned everything that they were. Basically, their entire job was owned by the overlords and their life, and so they break away from that. I don't think John is at all saying that violence is the way to break free from it, but in this movie, that's what had to happen.
It's also got, I mean, there's just, we do a whole show on just Mate One. The performance of James Earl Jones in just the one scene where he finds out he doesn't have to kill someone he thought he was going to have to.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Oh my God. I get teary eyed just thinking about it. He's so good And he's always good, but he's so good in that movie.
I think, I mean, I truly think that that's my favorite James Earl Jones part. He's just so good. And him and all these guys come in on a train, and they're considered scabs. And it ends up that these laborers, all of the people in West Virginia, and then the Italians that were living there as well, they all band together in kind of this camp outside of the town to make this work. And Chris Cooper goes around the area kind of rallying the troops to create a union. And it shows, it's a great school lesson of how basically a union gets put together. And again, it's all just people trying to fight for a fair wage and not become a new generation of slaves.
Yeah. It's a beautiful film.
All right. Let's go to 1978 and talk about Superman.
I don't get it. I don't get it. Why is it?
That's not mythic.
Nothing mythic. Terrible. We're going to cut this part.
I don't know, Josh, you can begin on this one and I'll jump in. you can at least run through what Superman is if you want to.
Oh, I think people know Superman.
I think we've had enough origin movies for the rest of our lives.
I remember, you know, I was a kid when that came out, and it was, I gotta say, I've always said, cause my father dragged me off to see, you know, there weren't that many movies for kids when I was a kid, which I think is a good thing. So I was, you know, we'd go off to Altman movies, and every now and then something like Superman would come along, and it was such a thrill. But if you had told me back then that someday I could live in a world in which everything was Superman and every now and then you get an Altman film, I'd say, I think I'll stay here. It was revelatory. I believed a man could fly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we couldn't afford a VCR when we were kids, my family. So we would rent a VCR, and pretty much every time we went, we'd rent Superman with a couple other things, but we loved that movie so much. And I think in this conversation of American mythics, I mean, that one's almost the top of the list in some ways. It's had a gigantic cultural impact. This movie, which was directed by Richard Donner, kind of started this whole superhero craze, taking it seriously and making it work. And I still think his work's better, if not the best of all of them, barring maybe The Dark Knight. But Superman is just a really amazing way to go about making these movies. And I think that something that's worth noting is that at some point it's going to feel like a rebellion or a complete revelation when somebody makes a superhero movie that celebrates the joy of being a hero and not the weight that you carry, the pain of being a hero.
No, but that's the Marvel contribution, you know, the neurotic, that was supposed to be a wonderful change from the standard superhero thing.
It was.
These people are they're neurotic. They've got problems. I mean, if you were a super person, you'd have a lot of problems too. And okay, I get it, you know, but now I've been getting it for the past 5, 10, 12 years of just the same thing, the same beats over and over and over. Whereas when you go back to the Donner Superman, you're right. I mean, there's a sense of joyousness to it. I mean, it's like this is a fun idea. It's got the whole Jor-El thing, and it's also got the longest credits in the history of movies.
And they're fun to look at.
Yeah.
Credits are great.
And it's really well cast. It became a model, I think, for those pictures. And I think that it does get a little campier with the Gene Hackman, Ned Beatty stuff than the rest of the movie is. Even so, it's still it's when you compare it to Superman 2, which is a hybrid of what Donner shot and what Richard Lester came in and reshot, and then you get into 3 and 4, there's no doubt about it that the first one is the best one.
And there's a really great, if you can find it, there's a Blu-ray that has the television version of the movie. It's 3 hours long.
So I've been sitting on it for a while. Is it good? Is it worth it?
It is the absolute best way to see that.
Oh, really?
It is so good. It's so good. And I don't know if Richard Donner likes it that way, but it just it dives in a little deeper on some really beautiful character stuff. The sequence in space with kind of all of those what look like Douglas Trumbull visual effects as he's moving through space is a much longer sequence. I mean, it's a kind of a hallucinatory version of the movie. It's just so much bigger and so much more little character asides and moments. There's nothing in it that I would necessarily cut. I love that there's a shorter version, but the long one is my favorite one to watch, and it looks incredible. Whoever mastered that version, it looks so good.
And did they put the sex scene back in? Or?
I didn't notice that.
No, was it Chevy Chase who told Margot Kidder that there should be a sex scene in the movie? And
that sounds like something he might say
behind closed doors, and it'd just be her going, "Oh, Superman! Oh, super, super duper man!" Anyway, terrible, terrible bit. Wait, so is that your most mythic film? Is that the
no? We're still creeping toward climbing. We're got a couple left. But yeah, I mean, that's about, I mean, there's not a whole lot that needs to be said about why that movie is what it is, but it had to be on this list. I couldn't just ignore it.
Yeah.
And I might as well list some of the ones right now that we're not covering that people a lot smarter than me, would be great at talking about, like you guys. But we're not going to get to talk about Easy Rider or The Godfather or Rocky or American Graffiti or Lincoln or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid or Nashville or Taxi Driver. And I'm sure I'm missing some, and hopefully it'll get people talking about what very specifically these kind of movies can do. Because actually, when I looked at hundreds of movies, it really was only about 20 or 30 movies really kind of fit the bill here. All right, let's go to 1984, The Natural.
Sure, yeah.
It's a Barry Levinson film shot by Caleb Deschanel, based on one of my favorite books, if not my favorite book, The Natural by Bernard Malamud.
Have you noticed that every DP he's mentioned has already been on our show?
That's true.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all we've right. had Caleb and Ernest.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I got to go back and listen now.
Oh, now he has to.
I'll cover some of the reasons it's mythic. I mean, literally, it's based on the Arthur legend. It has the sense of magical realism. It has the Holy Grail, which is the pennant. That's right. What Pop Fisher is looking for. That's his Holy Grail. Pop Fisher is named after the Fisher King from Arthur lore. Roy's Excalibur is Wonder Boy. It's a bat forged from lightning. He plays for the Knights, which is a little on the nose. there's almost a Morgana character in the mysterious Harriet Bird character that shoots him.
Yep.
Roy and Hobbs come from the Latin words, which mean king and horse. So again, very on the nose. But there's a scene in the movie where he performs a coin trick at the table with Kim Basinger. Robert Duvall. No, it's one of the, I think the owners of the team is watching, and he kind of humbles him by doing this magic trick. But in the book, he literally does completely impossible magic. I think he pulls a pig out from under the table, something completely insane. That's completely, it's just not possible. So the book is willing to kind of go there. And then in the end, he fails and will be forgotten in the book. He basically agrees to cheat and throw the game. And then at the end of the game, he decides, no, I want to win. I want to do this right. But it's too late. He's already given up too much. And the pitcher that he stands against is too good. And it kind of is like that say it ain't so, Joe line. I think a kid comes up to him and says, say it ain't so, Roy. So the book and the movie are very different, but they're both mythic in very much the same ways. Just the movie ends with basically the Arthur legend having a happy ending, and the Holy Grail is captured.
Am I wrong? I vaguely remember, did they do a ending more faithful to the book originally?
Was it a reshoot? I don't think so.
Okay. My recollection is very vague. But yeah, great, great movie. And yes, I haven't seen it in a long time, and I don't remember catching all that painfully obvious stuff you're pointing out, but I'm sure I did.
Well, you were much younger.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I didn't catch it when I was a little kid. I think the only thing I caught when I was little was the bat kind of
reminded me
of a magical totem that he has with him. And then I think the knights thing I realized some years later. And then I read the book and it started to become really clear that there was a lot of connections there. And I mean, the photography in that movie, I think it's maybe the best looking movie I've ever seen. It's pretty darn close. I mean, I love the look of that movie, especially the sequence where Robert Duvall and all of them are kind of placing bets on them having a batting and pitching contest in the sunset. I mean, I don't know how many days they would have had to shoot that sequence at sunset, but it's pretty amazing. Do you know anything about that, Joe, how any of that worked?
Well, magic hour stuff is so complicated. You know, I see movies that have these beautiful scenes that take place in magic hour, and I go, well, it's going to all be one shot, right? Because the sun is setting. And then, no, there's another angle, and there's another angle, and you figure it's got to be more than one day. You've got to go back to that location.
Yeah, I've never looked into how they did it, but there's a lot of coverage in that sequence, and it just maintains this really gorgeous light throughout. And in the whole movie, well, next time you have Caleb Deschanel on, you can ask him how he put it off. So I think we'll close this list with my favorite from this list is in 1979 is Being There by Hal.
Oh, God.
Sublime.
Yes. Speaking of Caleb.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, there he is.
So he's the guy to go to for mythic American films.
Yeah. When I read the book before I saw the movie, which it's a good book, but it's very short. And I was just sort of racking my brain thinking, how are they going to make a feature film out of this somewhat slight little paperback? Mm. And I was so impressed when I saw the movie, how they managed to expand it into... Again, something mythic.
Yeah. I mean, it's a movie that when I first saw it, it was just an instantaneous feeling of that's maybe the best movie I've ever seen. I've consistently gone back to Raiders and The Conversation and Being There. I can't decide which one is my favorite movie, but this movie I just love so much and has such a good, sweet message. And it's just this simple, decent character who's alone in the world and was good at one task very singularly, and he's a gardener for an older man who passes away, and apparently there were no windows to the outside world, and he just kind of stayed in this house until he's, I don't know how old was Peter Sellers when this
it was one of his last movies. In fact, wasn't it the last one?
I think it was.
Well, it was. We all liked it. Say it was his last movie.
Well,
his
I think
last
that movie Fu
was
Manchu
the
movie.
Plot of Fu
yeah,
Manchu.
I think the Fu Manchu movie was his last movie. But he was up there, you know. But he was obviously a very problematic person, but obviously a great talent. And this is an amazing performance.
Yeah. I mean, he was 54
when he died.
Yeah.
He what?
He 54.
Was 54 when he
oh,
died.
Wow.
Jesus Christ.
So he gets... of the house, and because it gets it's basically goes into foreclosure, it's going to get bought after the guy he works for dies, and he goes out into the world and bumbles his way into basically the presidency by the end of the movie. Everybody at the presidency.
It can happen.
At the end of the movie, these guys are standing in front of a very obvious Illuminati-type symbol. It's this pyramid with an eye on it, which they're bringing his friend, Melvin Douglas, who plays Ben Rand, and talking about who could maybe be president next. And you hear all these voices kind of quietly discussing that maybe it should be Chauncey Gardner, this guy who's just worked his way up through the political scene in Washington. And the shot that ends the movie is him literally walking on water, which in any other movie would seem preposterous or offensive or stupid or whatever it might be. But for this movie, it's just the perfect.
It's perfect.
And the key to Chauncey Gardner is the fact that he has only watched television.
Right.
He doesn't know what's going on in the outside world, and he thinks everything that he sees on TV is real. And he has a remote that he brings with him. And when his first sojourn outside the house, he runs into these street kids, and they start razzing him. And he holds up the remote and keeps pushing it as if he pushes it, the channel will change. It's phenomenal. And he can't make love to Shirley MacLaine because he's too busy watching television.
Are you hearing yourself?
I know. Who do you think it sounds
Jesus
like?
God damn it. I mean, we all do face in the crowd and network and all that stuff, but my God.
No, right? Well, it's being there, we are now there.
Is it mythic if it turns out to just be true?
It's prophetic, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think that it's worth noting too that Forrest Gump I think owes a big debt to being there.
Yes, it does, but it's not fit to lick its boots.
Yeah, and I mean, some other things that I like about the movie are just it has a real sense of decency and honesty, but it does it in a way that is very very subtle and like Joe said, it's sublime. It's kind of a perfect movie, so. Yeah, that's my collection of movies that touch on American mythmaking.
That's a good bunch of stuff.
It is fantastic, and I can see a lot of I can see and feel the connection to your own film, which is nice. Those films clearly sort of channel through you while you're making that.
And you know, in today's world, your swastika wristwatch, I think, could really take off.
Yes.
I hope not. Somebody asked me, did you think this movie would be relevant when you wrote it? Because I wrote it 12 years ago, and I said, this movie was never supposed to be relevant.
Well, I highly recommend it for folks who are listening who have not seen it. It's all over now, right? It's on like the iTunes and the various and sundry.
Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime. Am I correct? Yeah.
As we speak, it's playing in select theaters.
And, oh yes,
and you can go see it if you can find it near you, and
you then can have that Sullivan's Travels effect of actually watching a movie with people around you, which is a different experience than watching it on your screen at home.
Crazy talk.
I know.
Well, Robert, thank you so very very much for coming on and talking to us. It's been a blast.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Joe.
And good luck.
And good luck with your future work.
Thank you both very much.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for the Movies That Made Me.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.